Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. Today's topic on Talk Nation Radio, the Iraq War and occupation and new authoritative evidence that this has been a war and occupation from start to finish about oil.
I found it remarkable in January 2003 in the same document. On the one hand, they said, we're going to sign contracts with big oil companies in order to increase Iraq's production up to 5 million barrels a day. We're going to do all this. And then 2 pages away from that, headed public diplomacy, i.e. what we're going to tell the public, it said, the line is, we're not going to do anything to influence the long-term shape of the oil industry.
The war for oil in Iraq has met with a great deal of success and also a tremendous amount of failure, in large part due to resistance by the Iraqi labor movement.
In early June 2003, around 100 or so workers who'd started to organize themselves decided that they were going to hold a protest to sort out this wage situation. And they arrived at 7 in the morning. They parked a crane across the access road, and so they caused a tailback of all the tanker trucks behind that crane. The British, who were controlling Basra, sent in the troops, who raised their guns. And what the workers did, they didn't run away. Instead, they walked up to the soldiers. Some of them tore open their shirts and showed their bared chests to the raised guns and said, "Shoot."
A newly published narrative describes the occupiers of Iraq as using divide-and-conquer tactics to split Iraqis along sectarian lines.
It was a U.S. hand that first established a political system based on sectarian quotas back in July 2003. And every time Iraqis rejected that and started to organize organize their politics in a form that was more natural to them, not on these sectarian grounds. It was a US intervention that said, hang on a minute, you're supposed to be Shia and Sunni, and separated them again.
So I'm thrilled to welcome as this week's guest on Talk Nation Radio, Greg Muddett, the author of an incredible new book called Fuel on the Fire, Oil and Politics in Occupied Iraq. Greg, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me, David.
It is wonderful to have you on here and to address this question that has never been satisfactorily answered in the U.S. communications system. Was the war on Iraq, is the occupation and the war on Iraq for oil? Were we right to shout, no blood for oil?
Well, I asked this question to a senior State Department advisor. He was the guy who advised the U.S. State Department in the run-up to war about what to do with Iraq's oil. And I said to him, so the government insisted it was nothing to do with oil, what do you think? And he answered, what did Iraq have that we would like to have? It wasn't the sand. And I think when you look at how much oil there is in Iraq, about a tenth of the world's reserves, when you combine that with those countries that surround Iraq and it comes to more than 60%, I think the idea that the oil question didn't cross their minds is a pretty far-fetched one. And so what I did was I followed what happened next to the oil and followed the documentary evidence. And actually I found oil at every twist and turn of the Iraq occupation.
In fact, you found a document, you've said, produced by an operation that Doug Feith had set up in the Pentagon that said both, effectively, this is all about oil and let's tell the public it isn't. Am I correct on that?
Yeah. So this was one of many documents I got through the Freedom of Information Act. Feith set up something called the Energy Infrastructure Planning Group in summer 2002, and for about 8 or 9 months, their role was to work out what the US was going to do with Iraq's oil once it arrived. And I found it remarkable. In January 2003, in the same document, on the one hand, they said, we're going to sign contracts with big oil companies in order to increase Iraq's production up to 5 million barrels a day. We're going to do all this. And then 2 pages away from that, headed public diplomacy, i.e. what we're going to tell the public, it said, the line is, we're not going to do anything to influence the long-term shape of the oil industry. They were recommending that the Bush administration lie to the public about its plans for Iraq's oil.
I doubt many are shocked that the Bush administration would have lied to us.
What's more surprising is that they put it in writing that they planned to.
Yes, again, not unprecedented, but but very useful. The resistance that you discuss in the book, not just by the peace movement here and in the UK, where you're from, but by the Iraqi people, the labor movement in Iraq plays a big role. How did the labor movement start to come back after shock and awe?
Well, this is one of the really positive stories about post-2003 Iraq, and there aren't many. Very soon after the dictatorship fell, workers started to organize themselves into trade unions, and the trade unions would play a significant role in shaping the subsequent years. And my strongest relationship is with the oil workers trade union in Basra. But they and the other unions were really formed from the bottom up. It wasn't some structure that was imposed that people could sign up to. It was workers themselves trying to organize themselves. And in the case of the oil workers, they organized with three objectives. One was, as you would expect, to defend the rights and interests of workers. But the second, it was they saw their role as custodians of the oil sector, and they wanted to protect it from privatization by the US-UK occupation. And then the third, which is perhaps more surprising, is they wanted to organize themselves to get production back on track. They saw it as their duty to their fellow Iraqis to make the system work. And so, with the managers all having run away because they were Baathists, it was these nascent unions that actually got workers in the facilities and getting the fields pumping again.
And a bit of a crisis developed quickly when none of the workers were getting paid.
Yeah, well, the liberation that was brought to Iraq didn't extend to freedom to feed their families, and no one was paid for the first few weeks of the occupation. One of the significant turning points came in Basra Refinery, which is one of three refineries in the country. In early June 2003, around 100 or so workers who'd started to organize themselves decided that they were going to hold a protest to sort out this wage situation. And they arrived at 7 in the morning. They parked a crane across the access road, and so they caused a tailback of all the tanker trucks behind that crane. The British, who were controlling Basra, sent in the troops who raised their guns. And what the workers did, they didn't run away. Instead, they walked up to the soldiers. Some of them tore open their shirts and showed their bared chests to the raised guns and said, "Shoot." Others of them dived under the tanker trucks and pulled out their cigarette lighters and said, "We're happy to talk." The British, recognizing a potential PR disaster here, ordered the troops to stand down and instead negotiated. And within 24 hours, all of the workers in the refinery had been paid their wages, and the membership of that union went from 100 to 3,000 in the space of a couple of days, because workers saw what this kind of action could achieve for them.
It's striking in your book, and I think will be surprising to many people, the extent to which these ordinary Iraqis saw themselves as having an interest in their nation as a whole, practically to the exclusion of what we're always told they cared about, which was sectarian differences. And in fact, you seem to have found a good deal of solid evidence that there was a use of a divide and conquer tactic in dividing Iraqis as Sunni and Shia.
Mm-hmm. Well, repeatedly, it was a U.S. intervention which dragged Iraqi politics in a sectarian direction. It was a U.S. hand that first established a political system based on political quotas, on sectarian quotas, back in July 2003. And every time Iraqis rejected that and started to organize in a form, organize their politics in a form that was more natural to them, not on these sectarian grounds. It was a US intervention that said, hang on a minute, you're supposed to be Shia and Sunni, and separated them again. This happened repeatedly after 2003. And all we were told about the US trying to bring reconciliation, actually the US was really at the heart of the problem. And as you say, it was absolutely in their interests to be.
We are speaking with Greg Muddett, who is the author of Fuel on the Fire, Oil and Politics in Occupied Iraq. And Greg, I was struck by a scene you describe a couple years into the occupation, where you're meeting with Iraqi labor leaders outside of Iraq and describing to them the content of the draft, a leaked copy of the draft oil law, or what for years in the United States was called in the media the hydrocarbon law, presumably so that nobody would know what the heck it was. this oil law was seen by them as not in their interests, and they determined to resist it.
Yeah, I mean, I was very privileged to be at that meeting where Iraq's trade unions decided they were gonna work to stop this oil law happening. By that time, in December 2006, it was about 4 months since the oil law had been drafted. The US was getting impatient for it to be passed onto the statute book. But what the unions did was actually incredibly simple. They started telling people about it. And this was the opposite of what had been intended for the oil law. The US and its allies in the Iraqi government had hoped that it would pass very quickly without anyone knowing about it, because they knew very well that most Iraqis believe quite passionately that oil belongs in Iraqi hands and should remain in the public sector. It's almost a question of national identity for Iraqis. The establishment of Iraq as a proud and independent nation is tied very closely to liberating themselves from foreign control of their oil in the 60s and the 70s. So in December 2006, Iraq's trade unions decided they were going to work to stop this oil law, this hydrocarbon law. And when they got back from the meeting, they started telling their members about it. They started publishing pamphlets. The Oil Workers Union in Basra held a conference in February 07, at which they invited not just many of the workforce, hundreds of the workforce, but also influential local people from political parties or from the mosques and so on. And just this act of talking about it got people to know about it. And I've consistently found that as soon as someone heard about it, they ran off to tell their family, to tell their neighbours, to tell their co-workers, who then did the same. And so word about this oil law spread very quickly, and everyone who heard about it was against it.
December 2006, this was a time when the peace movement here in the United States was relatively large and had influenced public opinion, and everyone had gone and voted based on opposition to the war, and we'd put in Democratic majority in Congress, and we were, some of us at least, hopeful that if we kept pushing, we might scale back this thing. And what did they do? They immediately escalated the war with the so-called surge. What was the connection between this surge, which I don't think we voted for, and the oil law?
So you're right. The surge was announced 2 months after the midterm elections, which were won handsomely by the Democrats on an anti-war, on an ending the war ticket. And the surge was an escalation. It was about sending an extra 30,000 troops to Iraq. Now, the way it's talked about in the US media, and most people seem to have bought this, the purpose of the surge was a noble one. It was to bring peace and security to Iraq. And so there's all this mythology developed around the character of General Petraeus, and this was the point that turned around the war. Actually, it wasn't noble at all. You only have to read the documents setting out that strategy, which were published by the White House at the time. The strategy was called the New Way Forward, and it had two parts. Part one was the surge: send an extra 30,000 troops, through them achieve military control over the country. Part two: use that military control to pressure Iraqi politicians to achieve political objectives. And they called these benchmarks. And there was one really important benchmark which they talked about all the time, every time they spoke to the Iraqi leaders, and that was pass this oil law to basically put big oil companies back in control of Iraq's oil industry. So that's perhaps a bit less noble, using the surge to lever big oil back into Iraq.
The surge not only didn't play the role in decreasing the violence that it's alleged to have played, but mm-hmm. it didn't get that oil law. What is the status now of an oil law in Iraq?
My book tells two stories. One is about how did the oil interests play out during the occupation. And I don't think very many people are going to be very surprised that oil was at the heart of all this. But the other story my book tells is a much more surprising one, and that is about what Iraqi civil society did. Again, we haven't been told this, but what's surprising is the level of success they achieved. And so the Bush administration was throwing everything it had at pressuring the Iraqi politicians to pass this oil law, while civil society was campaigning hard against it, and it had spread from the unions into a whole range of organizations. The result of their campaigning was that it became such a huge popular issue in Iraq, and again we weren't told this, in the US or Britain, it became such a huge popular issue that members of the Iraqi parliament felt they had to align themselves with public opinion on this, because the political cost to their future careers of not doing so would just be too great. The US administration, in order to try and drive this through, they set a deadline of September 2007, and they said, get this oil law passed by then, or else. And they made a whole number of threats, cutting off aid, not reducing Iraq's debts, even removing military support from the Maliki government, effectively threatening to topple the government. They set this deadline, September 2007, pass the oil law or else. And what happened was, by that time, because of the large popular campaign, a majority of the parliament had turned against the oil law, and so it couldn't be passed through parliament. The deadline came, the deadline went, there was no oil law, and there's no oil law today. And to me, that is a really, really inspiring story about what Iraqi civil society can achieve in the most difficult circumstances imaginable.
And yet, somebody got overruled, and the oil corporations began moving into Iraq nonetheless.
What happened was, a couple of years after the failure to pass the oil law, which would have legalized the role of multinational companies in developing the oil fields and running the oil fields, the Iraqi government decided, well, hey, maybe we don't need to legalize it. Maybe let's just continue without it being legal. And so in 2009, they started auctioning off their oil fields to the highest bidder. BP got the first one, and then Exxon got one, and then the Italian company Eni got one, and then Shell got one, and so on. And so these were 20-year contracts to run the largest of Iraq's oil fields. And these were signed in the absence of the legal authority for the government to sign them. This means the story isn't over. Even if it might look on the surface like big oil got what it wanted, or the US administration got what it wanted, that victory is a provisional one, because it's not a legal one. They've got illegal contracts which will last as long as they last, and if a future Iraqi government decides to tear them up, the companies won't have any legal backup. They can't point to their contract and say, hang on a minute, you know, you're infringing on our rights here, because they haven't got any rights, because they're illegal.
Is there a victory for nonviolent activism and organizing and education in Iraq? Is this a story of violent resistance to imperialism, or of nonviolent building of civic society that resisted the imposition of this exploitative oil law?
The successful struggle against the oil law is a really strong example of effective nonviolent resistance. There were demonstrations, public meetings, pamphlets, etc. And through those, they achieved this enormous victory in stopping the US achieving its number one objective at the time. The other significance of it was that September 2007, when the Bush administration failed to get its oil law, at that point, when they failed to get it, it showed up the limitations of US power. And I think that was the moment at which US influence in Iraq started to decline. And at the same time, a much more Iraqi kind of politics, a non-sectarian politics began to emerge, where Iraqis were talking about the Iraqi political system. I mean, this didn't change Iraqis' views. They'd always been non-sectarian. But in the political system, it started to reflect national interests rather than Shia or Sunni interests. And you know, you could say this oil law struggle not only was a success of non-violent activism, it also set the tone for an escape from sectarian conflict for a much more positive Iraqi political discourse.
So what lessons do you think the proponents of war and the proponents of war as a tool of Western oil and resource corporations have been taken from this? I mean, I've seen arguments, a prominent Israeli politician and others have made arguments that in some way this war has been a success. It has fragmented and destroyed Iraq. It's removed the mythical or otherwise the possible threat from Iraq. Certainly the weapons profiteers have done very, very well. If you wanted war powers expanded in the White House and sort of eternal war normalized in U.S. culture, if you wanted our civil liberties curtailed with a great excuse to do that, and if you wanted to get some kind of oil contracts, you know, sort of risky oil contracts as they might be, it's not a complete defeat. And you describe Libya and Iran as being listed as the next targets in sort of the pre-war energy slash war planning. And we've already seen a move into Libya, and the threats to Iran. Has anyone been chastened by this experience?
People have been chastened, and I mean, I think it's important to remember the respects in which they failed miserably. I mean, one of the central objectives of the Iraq War, and this is very clear from the documentary evidence, even pre-9/11, even in the build-up to the Bush administration, it's very clear that the way they were thinking about Iraq was, let's open up Iraq to foreign investment and thereby release the pressures, release the constraints in the oil market, and keep the oil price down. Now, at the time of the war, the oil price was $22, $23 a barrel. They didn't do very well on that. The oil price climbed to $150 by 2008. Even now, it's bumping around just below 100. And so that was a disastrous failure. I think actually it was an inevitable failure, because what they wanted to do was they wanted to achieve something in Iraq. They wanted to transform Iraq's oil industry in a way that Iraqis themselves were fundamentally opposed to. And they could therefore only do so through force. They could only do so by disrupting Iraq's oil production and disrupting the oil market as a whole, and thereby forcing the price up. The other consequence of trying to push through a set of objectives by force was that they created a political system that was controllable from outside, that didn't respond to Iraqi interests. And the consequence of that is, once U.S. influence started to decline, who stepped into that political vacuum but Iran? And so Iran has been massively empowered by the Iraq War and is now moving back into the target sites. And so, you know, when you say eternal war, I think that is the only way they can think about achieving their objectives. But even eternal war, and the vast majority of Americans are against such a policy, even eternal war, it can't deliver on their objectives. They want too much, it's too difficult, and they can't overcome this large-scale public opposition in countries like Iraq.
And I've heard you say on a similar theme at a public event where you were speaking about your book, that in fact we have repeatedly thus far prevented a major assault on Iran, and the assault on Libya by NATO did not involve a major ground force occupation. There at least has been this scaling back or this avoidance of risking the lives of what the U.S. media calls human beings in these wars. Is that an accomplishment?
It's a huge accomplishment. And I mean, you and I, David, are members of the anti-war movement, as are many of your listeners. And I think it's very easy for us to, you know, after all these months of organizing stalls in the rain on Saturday mornings to think, well, you know, they still went ahead with the Iraq war anyway, and it was terrible, and why do we bother struggling? I'll tell you why we bother struggling, because we have achieved huge amounts, and we will continue to achieve huge amounts. If you remember, the neoconservatives who were in control of the Bush administration in 2003, their idea was that they would move very quickly from Iraq onto Iran, and it looked like there was an Iran war set for 2005-2006. That didn't happen, and the reason it didn't happen was because the anti-war movement made the Iraq war into a political liability for the British and American governments. Eventually, we forced the withdrawal of the troops from Iraq. In my country, in Britain, the troops were withdrawn in April 2009 because they were just such a huge political embarrassment for the government. That was because of the anti-war movement. The same with U.S. troops having been forced to be gradually downscaled and then eventually withdrawn at the end of 2011, and the Libya example you mentioned. I think as an anti-war movement, we should be really proud of what we've achieved, and this should hearten us in our future activism.
We don't have many minutes left. What would you say to people who believe Iraq is better off and Iraqis are better off, and failures and shortcomings and things to tweak in the next go-round, notwithstanding, Iraq has been liberated? I think it's important that we answer this question as we look at Libya and potentially Syria and Iran and the next war. Is Iraq a better place?
I've always resisted making that judgment because it's not for me to say things are worse than under Saddam Hussein. But what's really struck me is the sheer number of Iraqis who have said that over the last few years, that things have been made worse. Now, in the hypothetical scenario that the US and Britain had gone in, removed Saddam and then left, perhaps things might have been better. But that was never what they were going to do. That's why I opposed the war in 2003, because I knew they would stay, and they would stay in order to achieve their strategic objectives, to satisfy their strategic interests. They're not altruists. They don't do things for human rights as much as they like to say they do, or for democracy. And so they stayed, and the longer they stayed, the more damage they did to the Iraqi social fabric and the Iraqi political system. Every time I saw Iraqi politics evolving in a more positive direction, it was the US who dragged the country back and said, no, the political system is sectarian. You have to work with these politicians who happen to be the most vicious and the most corrupt, and, you know, dragged the country into disaster. Now Iraqis are really struggling. They still don't have electricity. They don't have a government that represents them.
We have been speaking with Greg Muddett, who is the author of an incredible new book that you need to get a copy of, called Fuel on the Fire, Oil and Politics in Occupied Iraq. Greg, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christiane Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.